Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 25, 2014, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our Courthouse Steps telephone is on the GHG greenhouse gas case decided on Monday by the U.S. Supreme Court. That's Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back to our teleforum format Mr. Robert R. Gassaway. He's a partner at the Kirkland & Ellis Law Firm right here in Washington, D.C., and with that, Mr. Gassaway, the floor is yours. He's going to give us opening remarks of about 20 minutes, and then we'll get back to the audience with questions. But Mr. Gassaway, please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Dean, very much, and thanks to the Federalist Society for giving me this platform to discuss this interesting and important case. As Dean mentioned, I am a partner at Kirkland & Ellis LLP, and along with my colleagues Jeff Rosen, Jeff Clark, Bill Burgess, and Aaron Nielsen, we represented the Chamber of Commerce in the UARD case. Obviously, as Dean said, all the comments that I'll make today are on my own behalf and not those of the Chamber of Commerce or the Federalist Society or others. I'd like to start by running through four key takeaways that I get from the opinion, then go on to dispel three myths, and then to give a short preview of coming attractions. Now, just to set the background, Dean did mention that we're talking about the GHG case. And I think most people who are on the call the last time we did this, and probably most people on the call today, know that it's the first really big case in the line after the Massachusetts versus EPA case in 2007, held that greenhouse gases are air pollutants for purposes of the Act-wide definition in the Clean Air Act Section 302, and therefore that they're potentially susceptible to regulation under various Clean Air Act programs. The specific issues that the court decided on Monday had to do with the prevention of significant deterioration program, which involves controls and permits for large stationary sources, and the Title V program, which involves operating permits for large stationary source programs. And the controversy was joined because EPA had interpreted very aggressively certain statutory language under both the PSD and the Title V programs to allow it to pose a degree of burdensome regulation that was both deeper and wider in terms of number of sources than what had previously been experienced under those programs. The first key takeaway is just that the court sharply criticized EPA's overall approach to implementing the Clean Air Act. I think it bears heavy emphasis that the whole EPA approach, the whole EPA request for deference, the whole EPA bid to say, we need a program that addresses and effectively controls greenhouse gases, and we should be given a lot of leeway in designing that program and redesigning it over certain statutory language was squarely rejected by the court. I think it bears mentioning some of the specific passages from the opinion, and I'll run through a few of those quickly. The court said, quote, it takes some cheek for EPA to insist that could not possibly give air pollutant a reasonable and context-appropriate meeting that would have the programs work more as they had intended before. Many on the call, I think, are familiar with the earlier Brown and Williamson tobacco decision that was expressly approved by the court on Monday. The court said when an agency claims to discover in a long-extant statute an unheralded power to regulate, quote, a significant portion of the American economy, we typically greet its announcement with a measure of skepticism. The court said pointedly, since the statute does not compel EPA's agency-enhancing interpretation, it would be patently unreasonable, not to say outrageous, for EPA to insist on seizing expansive power that admits the statute is not designed to grant. The court swatted away the authority that the Solicitor General had cited as his best case, Morton versus Ruiz, said that is, quote, irrelevant. The court stated, were we to recognize the authority claimed by EPA in the tailoring rule, we would deal, quote, a severe blow to the Constitution's separation of powers. And finally, the court stated, we are aware of no principle of administrative law that would allow an agency to rewrite such clear statutory terms, and we shudder to contemplate the effect that such a principle would have on democratic governance. These are very pointed rebukes by the court to the whole approach of EPA to its interpretation. So that said, what is the effect of the decision? And my key takeaway number two is the court could not have been clear in announcing a category exemption for all small sources from PSD-based regulations of greenhouse gas emissions. That's no small thing. The court on page 17 of its opinion said, without some such holding, the number of sources subject to PSD in any given year could jump from 800 to 82,000. So the number of sources required to have operating permits on Title V could jump from 15,000 to, quote, about 6.1 million. But the court ultimately held that the PSD program and Title V are designed to apply to and cannot rationally be extended beyond a relative handful of large sources capable of shouldering heavy substantive and procedural burdens. So for all those thousands and millions of sources that were potentially subject to GHG-based regulation by EPA, either immediately or perhaps down the road as the program evolved, that's at an end. They will never, absent amendments to the Act, come under the PSD and Title V programs. My third key takeaway, and this may be the most important, is that contrary to some media reports, the court also set very clear and very significant limits on PSD-based GHG emissions controls for large sources. And there are a number of these, but there are at least five different limitations that EPA is going to have to negotiate on remand in order to effectively regulate large sources. And let's go through some of that from the language of the opinion. I think maybe the most important language in this regard is where the court says, we acknowledge the potential for greenhouse gas best available control technology controls, this is the case-by-case permitting under the PSD program, to lead to an unreasonable and unanticipated degree of regulation, and our decision should not be taken as an endorsement for all aspects of EPA's current approach or as free rein for any future regulatory application of BACT in this distinct context. And then it went on to talk about the petitioners, our side's worries that by allowing the PSD program and BACT controls to be extended to encompass GHG emissions, you would have EPA regulation of energy efficiency throughout the economy. The court, as to that point, said, assuming without even deciding, that BACT may be used to force some improvements in energy efficiency, there are important limitations on BACT that may work to mitigate petitioners' concerns about unbounded regulatory authority. And then it went on to run through some of those important limitations. Number one, there will be no fundamental redesigns of facilities. Number two, there will be no regulation of demand for energy from the electric grid. A friend of mine asked last night, could they regulate air conditioners? Answer, so long as the air conditioner is plugged into the grid, no, they can't make you have a more efficient air conditioner. Finally, there are two de minimis requirements, minor improvements in energy efficiency, such as light bulbs or for out. At most, you can only regulate the facility's equipment that uses the largest amounts of energy. And second, there's a de minimis limitation and requirement, not just on minor pieces of equipment within the facility, but minor emitting facilities themselves. So it says, EPA may require an anyway source to comply with greenhouse BACT, but only if the source emits more than a de minimis amount of greenhouse gases. And what is de minimis? The court says, we do not hold that even 75,000 tons per year of CO2 equivalent necessarily exceeds a true de minimis level, only that EPA must justify that selection on proper grounds. Now, one key battleground on remand is going to be, how do you measure de minimis? My partner Jeff Rosen has emphasized again and again that in terms of CO2 emissions effects, EPA has never really quantified the harms that it is preventing by the controls that it imposes, harms in terms of sea level rise or in terms of health and welfare effects, or even in some cases of temperature rise. So the question is what unit of measure is going to be used to count what is de minimis or not? Will that be a unit of measure based on emissions, based on CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere, or CO2 harms? Depending how the court and EPA answer that question, the de minimis exception could really be very, very large. The one thing that the court did seem to endorse was a approach to carbon dioxide control that I'm not sure is going to play a very big role as a practical matter. The court said that carbon capture is reasonably comparable to more traditional end-of-stack backed technologies, the technologies that can be required by the permitting, and petitioners do not dispute that. I think that's correct. I think we could not dispute that an end-of-stack technology like carbon capture is most analogous to traditional backed technologies. But the problem in the CO2 emissions context is just I'm not sure how practical that is for any kind of large sources, either large industrial sources or large utility sources. My fourth and final key takeaway is the court expressly invited follow-on challenges to EPA's large source regulations in future proceedings. So even after crafting all of those limitations, really on its own initiative, the court didn't stop there. It went on to make a couple of reservations in footnotes that suggested that there may be a second opportunity to come back and to make some of the arguments that were made and rejected in these proceedings. Let me just quote those two footnotes. The first one is footnote 9, where the court says the possibility that the PSD program's site-specific air quality analysis requirement may be inoperative as to greenhouse gases does not convince us that they must be categorically excluded from BAC, even though they indisputably are pollutant subject to regulation. We are not reviewing EPA's guidance as to what is an outside of BAC in these cases, and we cannot say that it's impossible for EPA and state permit authorities to devise rational ways of complying with the statute's directives in the future. So it may be too early to say that there's no rational way to implement BAC, but they're not precluding that. And then finally, in note 6, the court runs through some possible limiting constructions on the PSD trigger, and it says they've been proposed, including one that would limit the air pollutant subject to BACs to, quote, air pollutants with localized effects only on air quality. We do not foreclose, says the court's EPA, or the courts, the lower courts, from considering those constructions in the future, but we need not do so today. So even after putting forth and establishing all of the limitations for large sources that I just discussed, the de minimis limitation for specific equipment, the de minimis limitation for the facility, the no regulation of electricity consumption from the grid, the no fundamental design, the must be reasonable limitation, even after announcing all that, it comes back and says, even with all that, we're really still not even sure that you can go forward and have a rational program, or maybe we're still not sure you can have a rational program except in the instance of carbon capture and of stack technologies, which really don't play a very big role anyway. So with those four key takeaways, I think we're ready to quickly and easily dispel three myths that you may have heard from media coverage. One is that the decision was a fractured decision. This was not a fractured decision. All of the rules and principles and language that we just reviewed was adopted, embraced as holdings by a majority of the court. It's true that that majority shifted and waxed and waned depending on the specific part of the opinion, and I won't go into that. But at least five members of the court joined every part of the opinion. There were no plurality parts of the opinion. And some of the key limiting language, including the reasonableness language I began with, was actually joined by 7 members of the court, all but 2 members of the court. So this was not a fractured decision. This is a majority decision in all aspects. The second myth that you may have heard is that this was an EPA win or something closer to split the baby. I really do not see how you can say that. In terms of the principles involved, the interpretive principles involved, it's hard to think how EPA could have been rebuked in more uncertain terms by the court. In terms of the expansion or potential expansion to small sources, it's hard to imagine how it could have been rebuked more definitively. And even as to the large source question, which the court might have ducked and allowed EPA to deal with in the first instance on remand, it's hard to imagine a more extensive warning to EPA about the clear and significant limits that it will have to operate under on remand, together with even leaving the door open to the possibility that even all of those limits may not be enough. I know that lawyers have a hard time ever not looking at the bright side of the decisions of the cases that they're involved in. I may be subject to that. But as I have stepped back and read and reread the opinion over the past couple of days, this seems to be a very, very significant defeat for EPA, and I'm really not sure what, as a practical matter, of their current large source program remains in effect. It seems to me they'll have to go back to the drawing board. The third myth that I've heard from time to time, less often than the myth that EPA won, is that it was a muddled decision. I can see that point of view to a certain extent in the sense that I do think that there is clear language that says for the time being we're allowing EPA to go forward with large sources subject to these clear and significant limitations, whereas there are the 2 footnote reservations that I think pull back on that a little. So to some extent, I can see there being some tension in there. But in terms of the overall thrust of the decision, and aside from the footnote reservations that are often ambiguous in these sorts of cases as to scope, I really don't see the muddle. So briefly to wrap up within the 20-minute time limit that Dean offered, I also just like to offer a potential preview of coming attractions. And one is just to remark that I think this does open the door to a policy and political discussion among the branches, among EPA, and perhaps with the legislative branch and our congressmen getting involved as to how the PSD program should be shaped for GHG emissions going forward. I think before the people who are most involved in those discussions, and I'm certainly not one of them, but I'm relying on colleagues for this, report that those discussions were cut short by the idea that EPA was required by the current Clean Air Act to regulate GHG emissions under PSD and other programs. I don't think that interpretation of the Clean Air Act survived Monday's opinion, and I do think that it may and hope that it will provoke a more wide-ranging discussion at EPA and among Congress about how the BACT and Title V program should be applied to GHGs. And the second issue going forward is looking at the wider proceedings that are going on under Section 111, the NSPS issue, potential petition for rulemaking under the NAAQS provision. I think that there are 2 clear lines of argument that the court has laid down in asking, as it asks itself, whether any particular Clean Air Act program can accommodate GHG emissions controls. One has to do whether the particular program can sensibly regulate the type of pollutant that GHGs are, and the other goes to whether the particular program can reasonably accommodate, as a practical matter, the types of controls that would be needed to effectively limit GHGs. And you could see in Part A of of Monday's opinion, the first type of analysis, and Part B, the second type. And I think that that opens the door to the application of those two limitations on EPA authority under the new source performance standard, under the NAAQS standard, and I think those could be very significant going forward as EPA seeks to control GHGs under programs under the Clean Air Act, other than the motor vehicle program that is already in place. So, Dean, I see that I hit my 20 minutes exactly on the head. Why don't I turn it back over to you and ask if you have any questions or if you want to open up the floor?
Well, let's do a little bit of both. Let me open the floor. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our expert today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, Rob Gassaway, our lines are completely open right now. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who might ring in. Let me make a brief commercial announcement for Teleforma conference calls. Tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we're going to host another Courthouse Steps version of Teleforum on the Limelight and Nautilus cases. Those are important property rights cases that were decided a little bit earlier this term. And then on Friday, we will most likely host a Teleforum conference call on one of the cases expected to be decided by the court tomorrow. So you do need to check our website, monitor your emails for what's going to be sort of a dynamic schedule coming up. We have open dates for Teleforum calls tomorrow, Monday, and Tuesday, and we'll be trying to discuss the cases that are yet to be decided. For your information, those cases include the NLRB recess appointments case, that's Noel Canning, the HHS mandate case, Hobby Lobby, McCullen v. Coakley, which is the abortion clinic free speech case, and Harris versus Quinn, the unionization of personal care providers. So do try and keep up with your emails and check back on our website. One question I had for you, Rob, I just want to make sure I've got this straight in terms of the fractured versus non-fractured decision. Did I understand you correctly that every point of reasoning you mentioned and every principle you elaborated was adopted by at least five members of the court and some as many as seven members of the court, but that the five was somewhat shifting from one principle to the next?
That's exactly correct, Dean.
Okay. What sort of I'm interested in these footnote 6 and footnote 9, which you characterize as sort of inviting challenges or raising questions about other aspects here. Were those footnotes, if you know, this is maybe a level of detail you couldn't address, were those endorsed, was that reasoning endorsed by 5 or 6 or 7, or do you recall?
Footnote 6 was definitely in the five-person portion of the opinion. Mm-hmm. I think footnote 9 was in the seven-member portion of the opinion.
Interesting. And what do you see? And we do have a couple questions lined up in the audience, but let me just ask one more question. What might a future challenge look like? What form would it take? When would it be filed? Where would it be filed? By whom? I'm not asking for behind-the-scenes strategy here, but can you give us some idea of what that might look like going forward?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and I think there are two main possibilities there, each of which has its own particular advantages and disadvantages, either for an EPA that would try to aggressively regulate greenhouse gases, notwithstanding the opinion, or for a potential challenger that would try to fully enforce the opinion. One avenue would be, I think EPA has to greatly revise its guidance document for how GHG applies to large sources. I really don't see, having read that document in the course of the litigation, I haven't read it since the decision, but having read it months ago in the course of litigation, I don't see how they can stand pat. I don't see how EPA can say that guidance document still survives or enough of it survives that it really does provide guidance to permitting authorities at the state level about what's in and out in issuing backed permits to large sources. I can imagine EPA revising that guidance document, and I can imagine an attempt by petitioners to challenge the guidance document, recognizing all of the justiciability hurdles that would have to be overcome to bring a ripe and timely challenge to such a document. The other way I can imagine easily a challenge arising is in the context of a specific permitting decision. So I can imagine in that scenario, either a state permitting authority that reads this decision and says this really provides very, very narrow contours within which permits can be issued to regulate GHGs and allows a large stationary source to be built with controls that, say, an environmental group does not think are adequate, and the environmental group sues, saying that BACT really requires more. Alternatively, I can think of the other scenario where an industry asks a permitting authority to issue a permit for some plant that would emit GHGs. The permitting authority says you have to have additional controls. We can navigate the maze that was erected in the UARG decision. You haven't gone far enough. And then the industry group challenges that. But that would be two scenarios within a permitting context. And if I had to further handicap, I would say that the permitting context is more likely. And depending on the strategy of the other side, of the environmental groups, which I think are very cagey and very clever sometimes, I can easily imagine them trying to tee up a specific type of permit in a specific form that they thought was favorable and try to test the limits of this decision.
Once again, we're speaking with Rob Gassaway. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just two callers lined up with questions. Let's take our first call.
Rob?
Hello?
Rob, are you there?
Yes. Yeah, I'm here.
Randy Randall. Look, listen intently. Tell me about whether or not this decision has any effect on the pending existing plant NSPS proposal. Does EPA have to go back and retool, or can they proceed? Because, you know, we're in the comment phase now.
Yeah. I think that's a great question, Randy, and I gave a teaser at the end, and to be honest with you, as you know, that proposal is very long and very complicated, and I haven't gotten my way all the way through, but I will say this, is the two principles that I was talking about, the idea that just because a pollutant is a pollutant doesn't mean it's a pollutant for purposes of every program under the Act. I think that's an important principle, but even more, I think the sort of broad rationality restrictions that the court really fashioned on its own initiative in response to our arguments that it couldn't be rational, I think the court's sua sponte efforts to say, no, it can be rational, but in order to be rational, it's got to eliminate de minimis things. It can't really regulate things off-site for the grid. It can't require fundamental design changes. From what I know of the existing NSPS, I suspect that those sorts of principles, which the court elicited kind of from background principles of rationality, and fair construction of statute, my guess is they can be applied to the pending NSPS, and probably in the round of comments that are coming up, commenters should seek to try to apply them to that proposal.
Thanks.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We've got three caller questions pending now. Let's take another call.
Hello, Rob. It's Jack McMacken. How are you?
I'm doing good. Hey, Jack. How are you?
Great. I want to just make a comment on your answer to Randy's question. But first, maybe you could comment on this. Someone said to me this morning that their principle, I ought to say, I read the case exactly as you do. I think it's a tremendously significant defeat for the agency if we build on it correctly. Here's someone said to me this morning, they thought that the biggest source of confusion about the decision stemmed from Justice Scalia saying, EPA, we've given you most of what you wanted. You wanted to regulate 86% of the nation's emissions from stationary sources. We gave you 83%. I think what you're saying there that is missing is, yes, but as to that 83%, yes, the court says you can regulate it, but they hollowed out EPA's plans for how they were going to regulate it. And what's left, just as you say, right now, the only clear thing that may be left is some kind of bolt-on equivalent carbon capture and storage. Is that another way of saying this?
I agree with both those points, Jack. I agree that that is another way of saying it, is yes, you can potentially regulate the 83%, but it's undeniable that there are these multiple hoops that you have to run through. And it's undeniable that Justice Scalia, who wrote for a majority throughout, says we are not giving you free rein. It's undeniable that he said that petitioners' concerns are not unfounded, that the existing guidance gives rise to those concerns. But to address this, we remind you of the following principles that we just talked about. So I would say that that's exactly the point, is they can potentially regulate the other 83% of emissions, but they don't have a regulatory program, as I see it, in place today that actually does that or actually could do that. And I think in going back to the drawing board, the one thing that they have the clearest path to using for that regulation, the bolt-on end-of-stack carbon capture sort of technologies, I don't think they'll find that that's very practical as a solution. So I agree with that. But I also want to agree with the first point you made, Jack, which is just that the source of a lot of the confusion and the myth that EPA won, I do agree that the media reports of Justice Scalia's offhand comment from the bench is a prime source of that. I was not in the courtroom. I don't know if you were, if others on the call were. So I would kind of be interested in the context and the tone of voice and the overall expression of that. Obviously, Justice Scalia is somebody who speaks his mind freely from the bench in a lot of different modes. So. I can't really comment on what he was saying, but in terms of comparing just the 83% and where that come from and where that fits in under the opinion, I agree completely with your analysis.
Rob, if I can, just to get you to comment it further to Randy's excellent question on the implications of this for NSPS, I picked up on your second bullet where you point out the court cited Brown and Williamson. So for NSPS, the agency is going to have to claim that the standard there is ambiguous and broad because it contains the word system. And they're going to argue that a system includes everything that affects everything, and so you can go outside the fence and you can do energy efficiency and portfolio standards. Yes, but I think one implication of the court citing Brown and Williamson there and elaborating on it is they have revived Chevron zero for greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. And they've revived it for exactly the kind of situation where that we may have in NSPS, where it involves this, just as Justice Scalia says, what was involved in Brown and Williamson, and he cites MCI and the other Chevron Zero cases, a great big expansion of federal power, and where you do that, we are not in simple Chevron 2, where it's ambiguous and so it's for the agencies, not the courts. We may well be in a heightened scrutiny situation where it's for the court to say whether it's delegated at all.
That makes sense to me. I mean, and Jack, I think you and Randy and others have had more of an opportunity to look at the details of the NSPS proposal, but from what I know, and as I read this language, I would definitely be looking at the point that you're making there, the idea of reading into a long extant statute an unheralded power to wield authority over the entire American economy. People that I respect that have been through that very long document have said there are clear indications that you could describe what they're trying to do under NSPS in those terms.
Just for the, this is Dean Reuter again, just for the edification of our listeners, Robert Barnes of the Washington Post did quote Justice Scalia in speaking from the bench. He didn't provide the context, but I'll read the short quote here just so everybody has it. It bears mention that EPA is getting almost everything it wanted in this case. It sought to regulate sources that it said were responsible for 86% of all greenhouse gases emitted from stationary sources nationwide. Under our holdings, EPA will be able to regulate sources responsible for 83% of those emissions. So that's the language he quotes. Doesn't say whether it was a written summary from which Justice Scalia was speaking, or if he was speaking off the cuff, or other context. But there it is. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Well, first I want to thank you, Robert, for really insightful and clear explication of it. I wonder if you could kind of let your mind roam freely over the entire administrative state and suggest to what extent and where the language in the opinion or the holdings, including that about separation of powers and so on, might be used in things completely unrelated to environmental protection or air quality to roll back some federal excesses in the administrative state. I know it's early to do that. But.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. Look, I have long been an advocate of trying to use administrative law doctrines, both interpretive doctrines and sort of procedural and review doctrines, to try to give more clear running room for federal agencies. So one related area that you immediately think of is the D.C. Circuit's decision in demand response recently, where they came up with this idea, and my friend Ashley Parrish litigated that case successfully, so he could describe this better, but they came up with this idea of, quote, negawatts, where savings of electricity are subject to the same regulation as the generation of electricity. Obviously, in the view of the petitioners in that case challenging FERC, that was a big expansion of authority that was not justified by the statute. As I understand it, that opinion it may still be within the period for en banc review or certiorari review. But if I were litigating that, the idea of just coming up with kind of creative ways where inaction is action or non-consumption is consumption, that seems to be a little bit of a theme of recent executive action, whether you thought about, you know, the healthcare purchasing issue, the FERC issue, and so forth. And following on Jack's comment about the re-emphasis on Brown and Williamson, I think those sorts of creative interpretations, not just in the environmental context, but in other administrative contexts, are more subject to Supreme Court review and Supreme Court invalidation after this opinion.
Thank you.
Once again, we're taking questions. We've got two callers lined up, but if you'd like to be the third now, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, Rob. This is Greg Sopkin from Wilkinson Barker. Looking at this whole question of what effect this decision may have on the recently announced Section 111D proposed rule of the EPA concerning existing sources, part of the opinion states that there are important limitations on BACT that may work to mitigate petitioners' concerns about unbounded regulatory authority. And one of the examples of the bounds to regulatory authority is that EPA has long interpreted BACT as required only for pollutants that the source itself emits. Well, with Section 111D, a lot of people are arguing that the EPA cannot go outside the fence. But with Section 111D, instead of BACT, you have BSER, the best system of emissions reduction adequately demonstrated. So I'm wondering what is your opinion as to extending the thoughts of the majority opinion of the Supreme Court in the recent decision to Section 111D? Is it proper to do so, or is BSER qualitatively different from BACT, indicating that there should not be much reliance on that portion of the opinion?
Well, look, that's a great question, and I'm not ready to answer it now in the sense that before I did so, I'd want to take a hard look at 111 and a hard look at the statement that that you correctly quote, Greg, that EPA has long interpreted BACT as required only for pollutants that the source itself emits. I would look at that history. I would compare that under Section 111 for regulation there. It seems to me, from what I know, that 111 certainly has been primarily used in that context. I'd like to know if it's been used exclusively in that context as an absolute matter, and then compared to BACT, I'd like to know if it's been used more or less. But that is precisely the kind of argument that I think is what I would call presumptively transferable. As you mentioned, those limitations were prompted by the concern that that by extending BACT to include GHGs, would be quote-unquote unbounded regulatory authority. And I think as a threshold and as an initial matter, if you look at the proposal under Section 111, those concerns about unbounded regulatory authority, quote-unquote, are presented. And since they've had a sort of within-the-fence limitation that has now been clearly announced for BACT, I would certainly think very hard about whether that's transferable to Section 111, and the only reason I'm not willing to commit now is just because I haven't done the homework.
All right. All good advice. Thank you.
We've got one question pending, then our lines are open. Let's take another call.
Yeah, hi. This is Darren Bax from the Heritage Foundation. I had a question, maybe even a comment, I guess, about the the media is kind of minimizing the impact of the holding, as you've kind of discussed. And as relates to the tailoring rule, I mean, the key component is, yes, EPA may be able to regulate a significant percentage of the emissions, but as you mentioned, it's the fact that so many entities now won't be regulated under PSD and Title V as a result of the Supreme Court's holding, because the fear was because of the extreme nature of the potential of the tailoring rule was that so many entities could be affected by it. So I think that's really, to me, the story. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I agree completely. The tailoring rule was invalidated in its entirety. That is something that EPA spent a lot of thought considering. They took a lot of comment in delineating the cut points. They had a step one, a step two, a step three, and then subsequent steps. They said that over time, under the one step at a time doctrine, they were going to try to bring more and more sources into the program. That whole apparatus was invalidated in its entirety. All of those many thousands of sources that were potentially subject to future regulation, remember the statistic that I quoted of 82,000 under PSD and 6.1 million under Title V, those are all scot-free unless the Act is amended. And then you know, finally, the whole legal basis for doing a tailoring rule at all, the whole idea that EPA had this broad authority to try to, quote-unquote, tailor the act to make sure that it encompassed GHGs, because after all, in EPA's view of the world, MASFE EPA was the Magna Carta for GHG regulation. So we knew as a premise going in, the EPA said, that there had to be some way to regulate GHGs. The only question was how to do it most efficaciously. That whole premise and that whole approach was swept away in the strongest possible terms, invoking the Constitution. So I think that the invalidation, the complete invalidation of that rule, the complete repudiation of any authority to regulate small sources under another kind of rule, and the complete denunciation of the reasoning used to promulgate that rule, those should be the headlines. And then I think after that you get to the, you know, the large sources and whether they can or whether they can't. And on that, I think the headline is, yes, for now, but not under the current approach, only subject to strict limits, and then intriguingly, only subject to these footnote reservations that indicate that it could be that even more significant limitations would be found in the future. So I agree with that.
If I can, a quick follow-up. I mean, the tailoring rule was kind of an example of how the Clean Air Act really simply just didn't work when it came to greenhouse gases. The whole idea that the Clean Air Act should even apply to greenhouse gases made little sense when you looked at the structure of the law. So the EPA kind of had to force or basically tailor the statute to try to squeeze the greenhouse gases under the law. So I just don't remember. I don't think that in Massachusetts versus EPA they ever – whether or not that argument ever came up in terms of how the Clean Air Act, there's so many different aspects to the law that if you had this endangerment finding and it covered greenhouse gases, it just didn't make sense in the context of the broader law as a whole. And I don't know if you know whether or not that issue was brought up.
It was in the briefs in Mass EPA, and the advocates for Massachusetts made what I think was a successful litigation decision to say, we're only looking at the narrow question here. We're not dealing with stationary sources. This is a petition for regulation of motor vehicles, not for anything else. So the warnings that the Clean Air Act as a whole won't work if you extend it to GHGs are premature and not at issue in the case. And I think that the better view is that MASFE versus EPA did not answer that question. But as you say, I think it's incredibly significant that we now know at least one program, or if you want to call it that, one provision or part of a program where per se, GHGs cannot be fit within the regulatory structure, and that is, you know, this part of the PSD program where they say the act-wide definition of pollutant encompasses GHG, but there in the trigger of Section 169 and the corresponding trigger of Title V, pollutant in context does not encompass GHGs. I think that's huge, and I think what's also huge is the fact that even as to the other provision of the PSD program, the best available control technology provision, they say, for now, GHGs are in, but A, only subject to strict limitations, and B, the jury's still out. Let me just quote one other passage where the court says, it is not yet clear that EPA's demands will be of a significantly different character from those traditionally associated with PSD review. In short, the record before us does not establish that the BACT provision as written is incapable of being sensibly applied to greenhouse gases. Well, that yet is significant, and the record before us is significant, and does not demonstrate it's incapable is significant, because that leaves open what I think Jack McMacken was talking about, that after the case goes back to the agency and to permitting authorities and we get more experience under it, it may then become clear what is not yet clear, and it may be demonstrated that it is incapable of being sensibly applied to greenhouse gases because other than end-of-stack controls that aren't really available, there's not much that you can do to regulate GHG emissions from stationary sources.
Thanks a lot.
Final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're ready to see if anybody else rings in. Rob, let me ask you, on the point you were just discussing and also on the holding that EPA is not entitled to rewrite its statute, how strong in terms of numbers were the majority? Was that a portion of the opinion where there were five justices joining or seven justices? And do you interpret the language you just were discussing as sort of a warning shot over the bow of the EPA as it goes forward?
Yeah, the language I just read was joined by seven justices, and yes, I do interpret it as a warning shot over the bow of EPA because it was joined by seven justices, and the two that did not join it were Justices Alito and Thomas, and they've made pretty clear in this case, in the Mass versus EPA case, in the AEP versus Connecticut case, they really don't think that the Clean Air Act can work with regard to GHG emissions. So it would be very surprising if they would be unsupportive in the future of limitations on EPA. So I do regard that very much as a warning shot across EPA's bow. On your other question, Dean, having to do with the repudiation of EPA's interpretive approach, rewriting statutes and so forth, that was a 5-4 decision.
Okay. Well, I don't see any further questions. I'm going to give you a chance to wrap up and express any final thoughts you might have in doing that. I wondered if you'd answer one final question from me, and that is whether or not there was anything in the decision or the opinions or the dissent that that surprised you.
You know, I don't think it's that surprising. I think that much of this decision really followed what was ultimately the consensus position of the petitioners. And I guess one of the lessons learned from this case was after having obviously a lot of different industry groups and a lot of different petitioners and a lot of different briefs, I think we did do a fairly good job at the reply brief stage of getting together on a joint reply brief. Plus, obviously, you are going to have a separate brief being the lead party in Texas as the state, but really coordinating pretty well. And I think the messages that we tried to focus on were followed throughout. I will say that the cleaner logic of Justice Alito, which is not extensively rebutted in the majority opinion, is certainly closer to what we argued in our reply brief, and that certainly would have been a cleaner win. And to that extent, I think people who say that the EPA got part of a loaf are right. I think that the one thing that is notable, and I don't know if it's surprising, but I think that the one thing that is notable is having rejected the clean approach of Justice Alito, it really was open to the court, Dean, to just do the first part of their opinion, part A of the opinion, to say that the tailoring rule was all wrong, that EPA's whole interpretive approach was improper, that they'd overstepped their bounds, that it was inconsistent with separation of powers, and call it a day and say, okay, EPA, we've told you that your whole approach is wrong. You go back and you figure out what you can do. And having done that, they didn't stop there. They, as to that other 83% of emissions, they made these extensive comments and announced these extensive limitations that I've been talking about. And they really did a lot of their own work in doing that. They dug into a guidance document that we brought to their attention, but that the EPA itself really didn't have a lot to say about. And to get an indication of this, look at the part of the opinion that begins EPA argues, and look how when they're talking about EPA argues, ordinarily in a Supreme Court decision, that means the Solicitor General in a brief or an oral argument. Here they cite all the way down to a guidance document, footnote 86, and that's a key part of the court's language. They're talking there about carbon capture and traditional controls. So they really are going out, looking through the guidance documents, taking seriously the possibility that this accusation that our side made of regulatory overreach had a foundation, and rolling up their sleeves and trying to come up with obvious principles from the language of the statute and from administrative practice to foreclose that in the first instance, rather than doing what I think is done in some other cases, which is just to say, we've reviewed the rule that was before us, the tailoring rule, that's wrong, EPA, go back to the drawing board. So I think that the court's willingness to roll up their sleeves and to go out of their way to announce these limitations should be read as something that's very significant. I'll close on saying something, the second thing that I think is remarkable and significant, and that is the dog that didn't bark in the case was really any principle that I can think of off the top of my head that the Solicitor General put forward, either in argument or in briefing, that was embraced by the court. And if you go through the opinion and look at the points where they're talking about the Solicitor General or the advocacy, almost all of the instances are ones where they're saying the Solicitor General concedes, as he must, and, you know, building off the concession. Or in one case, the Solicitor General suggested that maybe if you redefine the pollutant from all GHGs more narrowly just to include carbon dioxide, that might make some difference. And the court said, well, we're not dealing with that now because that's not the regulation. But when the court is dealing with arguments from that side of the case, from the Solicitor General of the United States, in this opinion, which is certainly one of the most significant opinions of the term for the Solicitor General and for his clients in the administrative agencies, it's really very, very difficult to find anything, any point, much less any holding that the Solicitor General carried. I think the most favorable citation to advocacy from the other side is a citation to a Calpine amicus brief that says that permitting is going well. But other than that, despite the fact that this was a majority decision, I don't really see any advocacy and any proposition that the Solicitor General put forward in order to persuade being accepted as persuasive. And I think that's notable as well, Dean.
Well, thank you so much, Rob Gassaway, for joining us today. This has been a most interesting discussion. I want to thank our audience also for dialing in, and a reminder to our audience that tomorrow at 1 p.m. we're going to host a conference call on the Limelight and Nautilus cases. Those are property rights cases from earlier this term, patent cases decided earlier by the Supreme Court. And, of course, in the coming days, our schedule will be evolving to cover the four big cases remaining from the term. So do a reminder to look at your emails and check back on our website for the schedule as it develops. But until that next Teleform conference call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Dean, very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.